Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney. Coming up, the right to die case that's divided a father, mother, and son-in-law.
Tommy Chong of Cheechen Chong is jailed in a drug paraphernalia sting. His family says he's not the character in his movies.
Behind one of those doors, Bob,
number three,
is 50 pounds of Lebanese blonde hash. Makes your eyes red just thinking about him, huh?
Also, sports from the mouths of babes.
Oh, Yankees, we long to hate you. We're gonna meet you.
These stories and Americans targeted in Gaza, coming up here and now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Carol Van Dam. U.S. officials say a team from the FBI will head to the Middle East to investigate today's roadside bombing that killed three Americans. Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat is among those who've condemned the attack. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Yasser Arafat called the attack on an American diplomatic convoy an ugly crime and ordered an investigation into the blast. Both Hamas and Islamic Jihad denied they had any involvement in the attack. Israeli officials said it was evidence that no one is immune to Palestinian terror. The three Americans, all security guards hired from a private company, were killed when the armored jeep they were driving in was destroyed by a roadside bomb in northern Gaza. The American officials, including a cultural envoy from the U.S. Embassy who was not wounded, had come to Gaza to discuss the awarding of study grants in the U.S. to Palestinians. After the attack, the U.S. Embassy in Tel Aviv advised all American citizens to leave Gaza. Linda Gradstein, NPR News, Jerusalem.
It's day two of jury selection in Virginia Beach, Virginia, for the murder trial of John Mohammed, one of two suspects in the Washington area sniper shootings. Mohammed pleaded innocent yesterday to killing 53-year-old Dean Harold Myers. Myers was pumping gas when he was shot in the head a year ago. A prosecutor in the case says he expects to have his 12 jurors and three alternates by the end of the day. A Senate committee has approved the nomination of Utah Governor Mike Leavitt to head the Environmental Protection Agency. The committee's vote had been delayed by Senate Democrats, who now pledge to block the nomination on the Senate floor. NPR's Howard Burkus has more.
Committee Democrats joined Republicans in supporting the president's EPA nominee, despite objections to Bush administration environmental policies. There's also dissatisfaction with responses from the White House and Utah Governor Leavitt to Democratic requests for information on environmental issues. But Leavitt himself gets bipartisan praise for his consensus approach to policymaking and his leadership among governors. Still, at least four Senate Democrats, including three presidential candidates, say they'll block a confirmation vote by the full Senate. They want the White House to clarify clean air policies, acknowledge the existence of global warming, and review alleged political meddling in the EPA's response to the September 11th attacks in New York. Howard Burkus, NPR News.
A Chicago Cubs fan was escorted from the stadium for his personal safety after he interfered with a foul ball in last night's game against the Florida Marlins. The Cubs lost their 3-0 lead after that play. The Marlins went on to win 8-3, forcing a final Game 7 tonight to determine which team goes to the World Series. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Industrials are down 8 points to 9804 in active trading of 608 million shares. The Nasdaq is up 3 points to 1947. This is NPR News. In NPR's business update, new retail sales figures from the Commerce Department show consumers did less shopping last month than they did in August, marking the first drop in retail sales since the spring. After a spending binge in July and August, retail sales fell 0.2% last month, as expected. The government says if auto sales are excluded from the mix, retail sales increased 0.3%. The revised August increase is 1.2%. That's twice as much as what the Commerce Department reported earlier. General Motors reported improved earnings for its third quarter. Detroit Public Radio's Craig Folly reports.
General Motors earned $425 million in the quarter, a huge improvement over its $804 million loss for the same period last year. The earnings amount to 79 cents per share. The per share earning easily bested Wall Street analysts' expectations of 66 cents per share. General Motors says successful performance in its financing arm and an increase in U.S. market share helped secure the greater profits. GM's share of the market climbed to 28.7%, up from 28% 1 year ago. General Motors also announced today that it now expects to go above its original earnings target of $5 per share for the year. The company says it has what it calls reason for optimism for increasing its earnings projections. For NPR News, I'm Craig Fawley in Detroit.
Chipmaker Intel has beat Wall Street expectations in its third quarter earnings and is expecting a good fourth quarter as well. Strong computer sales doubled the company's profits compared to last October. Revenues are up 20%. In overseas trading, Japan's benchmark Nikkei stock average slipped lower in Tokyo. Other markets in Europe and Asia are higher. I'm Carol Van Dam, NPR News in Washington.
The NPR Shop introduces the music compilation Shake These Blues, the latest release in the I Heard It on NPR CD series at npr.org.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Sometime later today, doctors in Florida will remove the feeding tube from 39-year-old Terry Schiavo. Schiavo has been in a vegetative state for 13 years. Her heart stopped beating briefly in 1990 and left her severely brain damaged, unable to speak or feed herself, and some say unable to think or feel. Her husband, Michael, has been fighting in court to remove the tube, claiming Terry once said she would rather choose death over such a life. But she left no written instructions, and her parents and siblings, along with several Right to Life organizations, have argued that she is struggling to live and could perhaps be rehabilitated. A state Supreme Court judge sided with the husband, and once the tube is removed today, Terry Schiavo is expected to die within weeks. George Annis is a medical ethicist at Boston University. Welcome, George.
Hi.
Well, when Terry Schiavo's feeding tubes are removed, what happens to her? Does she starve to death?
Well, how you describe it is a very human interest thing. But basically what you're doing is you're stopping a medical treatment in this case, which is artificial delivery of food, similar to stopping cardiac resuscitation. If you were trying to resuscitate her and her heart stopped and you couldn't get it started again, similar to removing any type of active intervention that would be keeping a patient alive that is no longer benefiting the patient or that the patient doesn't want.
And so, as you say, it's certainly not unprecedented.
Not at all. I mean, I don't want to say it's routine, but it certainly does happen every day in hospitals and nursing homes around the country.
What about this huge fight between two sides of the family? How precedented is that?
Well, it's unusual. Most of the cases that go to court, it's usually a battle between, or historically it's been a battle between the physicians who didn't want to do something and the family that did want to do something. What the courts have decided over and over again, and there's just no dispute on this, is that the person who should make this decision is the patient themselves. So the only issue in front of the court, if it gets to court, is what would she have wanted? And if she'd written something down, that would be very nice, but hardly anybody writes anything down like this because none of us like to contemplate our own deaths.
Well, as I said, her doctors, her husband's doctors, and court-appointed doctors all say that Terry is in a persistent vegetative state, but her parents' doctors say she could one day eat on her own with therapy. They have video they claim shows her reacting to her mother. Why that discrepancy?
There is some dispute among some physicians, although most neurologists would say it's a pretty fringe group, about what a persistent or permanent vegetative state is and how easy it is to diagnose that. But that actually really doesn't matter. The question, again, is not what her precise medical diagnosis is or even her precise prognosis. The question is, knowing these facts, what would she decide if she could talk herself?
But, George, what's the legal answer to that question? In other words, if someone has not written a living will, who is legally next in line to decide? Is it the husband or is it the parents?
Well, it's the spouse in almost every state, including the state of Florida. The spouse becomes essentially your guardian. I mean, in this case, he was legally the guardian, or is it still legally the guardian of his wife? And your guardian gets to make the decision, but the decision has to be first what you would want. Your guardian doesn't get to say what he would want or what your guardian would want. The decision is to implement the decision that you would make. And if you can't do that, although in this case the judge thought they could do that, the judge found that she would not want to continue to survive like this. But if you can't do that, the much harder question is what, and this is what people are arguing about, what's in her best interest objectively? What do we think is best for her if we had no idea what she would want? And that's a hard question, but that's not the question actually that's being litigated.
The parents don't seem to have any other legal avenues. Governor Jeb Bush filed papers with the parents, but he has no veto power. What do you, George, as an ethicist, take from this?
It's complicated, but what I would take from this is everyone listening, even though it's hard to do, should at least tell their spouse and their children how they would want to be treated if they were in Terry's condition.
Tell more than one person.
Tell as many people as you can, because what's going to happen once you are in a coma or persistent vegetative state is you will no longer be involved in decision-making about your own care. Other people will be making those decisions, and I think it's only fair to your family that you tell them how you'd like those decisions to be made.
George, thank you.
You bet.
George Annis is a medical ethicist at Boston University. Terry Schiavo's feeding tubes are expected to be removed today.
It's not legal to smoke pot, but it is legal to talk about it. The Supreme Court has decided not to hear the Bush administration's request that physicians be punished for recommending marijuana for medical uses. Though federal law bans the use of marijuana under any circumstances, 9 states have legalized it for people with physician recommendations or prescriptions. And now the Supreme Court has upheld the physician's right to discuss marijuana with their patients. Joining us to discuss the impact of that decision is Bruce Merkin of the Marijuana Policy Project. He joins us from San Francisco. Hi, Bruce.
Yeah, I'm glad to be here.
Bruce, thanks for joining us. How much difference will this make to someone suffering perhaps from cancer who may want marijuana to alleviate their pain?
Well, this will make a huge difference because their physician can now give them honest advice about the medical use of marijuana without fearing John Ashcroft looking over his shoulder and perhaps taking away his medical practice. For all of the folks, both in states that have medical marijuana laws and states that are considering them, what this means is that the Supreme Court has cleared away the only serious legal threat to those laws, because the right of physicians to recommend marijuana is the central underpinning of all of these state laws. And they've really cleared a space for states to act to protect medical marijuana patients. So this is a tremendous historic step.
Do you expect states to step into that space and make marijuana available in many more states to people who say they need it for their pain?
We do think that this will help, because one of the concerns that repeatedly is raised by state legislators is that, well, we're not sure if we have the right to act. Does the federal government preempt this? And that the Supreme Court now has cleared away some of that confusion.
Yeah, but federal law is not about to change, is it? And federal law says it's against the law to smoke pot.
But the federal government can't dictate state law. Mm-hmm. And the vast majority, 99% of marijuana arrests and prosecutions are done by local authorities acting under state law. And states can say, we're not going to arrest and prosecute seriously ill people for using medical marijuana. Mark my words, federal law will change because it's irrational, it's unscientific, and it's not supported by 80% of the public.
Let's be really hard-headed. You spend most of your time dealing with this issue. How realistic is it for many states, a majority of states, let alone 50 states, to someday allow patients in pain to use marijuana?
I wouldn't be surprised, frankly, if we saw the whole national picture change within 5 years. I think we are really, really close to the tipping point, as some would describe it. There's no question of public support for this. There's a growing understanding among political leaders that it's not a threat to their political career to support legislation like this. We had a Republican governor in Maryland sign a medical marijuana bill this past summer. And frankly, it's just a few zealots, fanatics, who are still opposed to this.
Well, now, zealots, fanatics. I mean, there is concern that marijuana can hurt people.
Well, the fact is that every objective review that's ever been done, including the one commissioned by the Drug Czar's office a couple of years ago from the Institute of Medicine, found that the risks of marijuana are well within the risks commonly accepted for prescription drugs. Mm. The DEA's own administrative law judge referred to it back in 1988 as one of the safest therapeutically active substances known to man.
Bruce Merkin, thank you very much for joining us on this.
All right. Thank you for having me.
Bruce Merkin is with the Marijuana Policy Project in Washington, D.C. He spoke to us from San Francisco.
Well, the U.S. Justice Department is cracking down on the trafficking of drug paraphernalia in the United States. Dozens have been indicted, and one has been sent to jail.
And now it's time for America's favorite daytime fun show, Let's Make a Dope Deal. Yes, Let's Make a Dope Deal, where young pushers try to parlay their stash into that really big...
That's Cheech and Chong, the prototypical pothead duo of the 70s. One half of the act, Tommy Chong, went to jail last week after pleading guilty to selling bongs across state lines. But Chong, his family, and his friends say the feds are going after the wrong guy. Joining us on the line is Chong's attorney, Richard Hirsch. And Richard, Tommy did plead guilty after he was caught in a sting operation selling glass water pipes or bongs online across state lines. It sounds like he is the right guy.
He may or may not be the right guy, but it's the wrong crime. This is a law that hasn't been enforced in the United States since the early 90s. In fact, I have to tell you that some of the prosecutors in charge of drug cases out here in California didn't even know the law existed.
And this law comes from a 1994 Supreme Court ruling banning the sale of drug paraphernalia across state lines. So tell us, would it have been legal if Tommy Chong had sold his products, let's say, just in a storefront?
If he had sold it in California, if he had just shipped it in California, he would never have been prosecuted.
Is there a sense, too, that, and some of Chong's family has said this, that the government might feel they're actually sending to prison Tommy Chong, the character?
The government, in some of their papers that were filed with the court, indicated that Tommy profited in his career because of glamorizing the illegal distribution of marijuana. And they cited the movie Up in Smoke, which was made in 1978, 25 years ago. So clearly, I think the government indicated in writing that they were asking Tommy Chong to be punished because of whom he portrayed and not necessarily because of what he did. And I'll also point out to you that I believe of all the defendants sentenced so far, he's the only one who's received a prison sentence.
Tell us, who is Tommy Chong now if he's not the pothead of the Cheech and Chong movies and stage act?
Tommy Chong is 65 years of age. He has a family. He's been married for many, many years. He has a number of children. He's an upstanding member of the community. He's a very charitable person who's been doing a great deal of volunteer work here in the Los Angeles area. He was asked by the National Juvenile Drug Courts to be their spokesperson. And in spite of all this, the judge sentenced him to 9 months in prison.
This federal sting was called Operation Pipe Dreams. It's a campaign from Attorney General John Ashcroft to enforce this 94 Supreme Court ruling banning the sale of drug paraphernalia across state lines. Why do you think the crackdown is coming now?
It's a very good question. I can speculate that perhaps it might be to show how tough this administration is against drug crimes, but there were no drugs involved in this case. We're talking about the sale of glassware. In fact, much of this glassware was in art shows here in the Los Angeles area.
What do you say to people who were made uncomfortable by what they'd see as the glamorization of drug use?
Well, let me just put it this way. I think our governor-elect, the same thing could be said, that he glamorized violence, that he glamorized shooting people, killing people. It's absurd. It's comedy. It's satire. The characters that Tommy Chong and Cheech Marin portrayed in their movies were losers. Rather than glamorizing marijuana, they were showing that if you use marijuana, if you're pothead, you're going to end up in trouble with law enforcement, you're going to end up kind
an
of
idiot.
Losers on the fringe of society. Yeah, they were idiots.
Well, Richard Hirsch, thank you very much.
Thank you, Robin. It's a pleasure being with you.
Richard Hirsch, attorney for Tommy Chong, who's just begun a 9-month prison sentence for selling glass water pipes over state lines over the Internet.
Just ahead, cursed, the Cubs, the Red Sox, forever the bridesmaids.
And later in the program, author and attorney Scott Turow's journey to a position on the death penalty.
More coming up here and now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Oh, they were so close, so close. Last night, the Chicago Cubs had a 3-0 lead against the Florida Marlins going into the eighth inning. Then, with one on and a 3-2 pitch, a fan snatched a foul ball that a Cubby might have caught for a sure out, and that seemed to unleash the Florida Marlins, who went on to win with a postseason record 8 runs. And the Red Sox head to New York, but they better swing by Fenway Park on the way because it seems they left some players on base, 7 to be exact, losing last night to the Yankees 4-2. Prospects for a Cubs-Red Sox World Series are looking bleak. Chicago Sun-Times columnist Ron Rappaport comments on sports for NPR, and he joins us on the line from Chicago. Ron, Chi-Town was so pumped up. How deflated is Chicago today?
How deflated have you got, Robin? Let me tell you something. If they lose tonight, this is worse than fire, and they didn't have the fire on television, you know.
The Chicago Fire, of course. But it could all be over for both teams tonight.
Yeah, very much so. You can't be a true Cub fan or a true follower of the Cubs and not see the disaster that's waiting for them here. This and everybody is pretty much in agreement that if they lose tonight, if Kerry Wood can't win tonight, this is going to be the worst Cub flop ever.
Well,
I mean, they had everything their own way at home with their two best pitchers, the two best in the league, and so on. Robin, I've got to tell you, my daughter and her husband flew in from Boston, where they live, and have started picking up on the Red Sox, but she was raised a Cub fan. So she was in the bleachers last night, and they were counting down the outs, 9 to go, 8 to go, 7 to go, 6 to go. And so she's going to be back out there again tonight, hoping for the best.
Well, and
in the meantime, the Red Sox aren't doing much either.
Well, I was going to say, the Red Sox, Nomar Garciaparra looks like he's going to have a nervous breakdown with his pregame hitting rituals. And he actually doesn't look well. And, you know, he's just not hitting. And neither are some of the others.
You know, Nomar's honeymoon coming up with Mia Hamm isn't going to be all that thrilling. You know, the two of them are going to have a lot of disappointment to talk about, it sounds like. I don't know what the problem is with the Red Sox. It just seems like the Yankees have their number. I'm wondering if that big fracas that they had to Pedro, when Pedro Martinez buzzed Kerim Garcia and everything that happened after that, didn't take something out of them. I'm not sure what it is.
Or put something into the Yankees.
Could be.
By the way, the fan in Chicago who snagged that foul ball, taking it away from Moises Alou, what's happened to that fan today?
Well, he's incognito as far as we know. It's still early, but, you know, they showed him on TV so much that somebody's going to recognize him. What's funny or not so funny is that they dressed him up they found another coat for him and snuck him out of the ballpark. They threw out a number of people from the park who were threatening him. A lot of people are surprisingly forgiving, and so is Alou, by the way. He said, you know, it's the natural reaction of a fan. Any fan in any ballpark tries to get the ball. He was pretty good about it after the game. But there are enough Cub fans out there, just plain old Chicagoans, who are very upset at this young man. A lot of the response is it would be a very good thing if the Cubs won tonight just to get him off the hook.
Right. Well, and by the way, our listeners in Florida and New York are saying, and your point is what, as we complain
about
Chicago and the Red Sox. But isn't it true? I mean, will there be even half as much interest in a Florida-New York World Series?
No. I mean, the network Fox is on record as saying that they want the Cubs in this. They don't care whether it's the Yankees or the Red Sox, because both of them have great followings. But the ratings for the playoffs so far have been tremendous. They've been up 50% over what they were a year ago. Now, a lot of that has to do with the simply great games that have been played. Yesterday's was only one in a series of them. But there is this whole Cubby nation, Cubby hex, Cubby curse business going on. And frankly, if the Marlins get in, that's going to deflate a lot of that. I know the people in Florida don't want to hear that. But on the other hand, they don't always go out to support their team that much either. So it's pretty much out there.
Well, they probably see what it's done to us in Boston and Chicago, and they're thinking it doesn't seem so healthy.
Maybe they're well off. Maybe they're happy. They can just go to the beach and laugh it off.
Ron, thank you.
My pleasure, Robin.
And best of luck tonight.
Yeah. Okay. I'll pass it on to the Cubs.
Ron Rappaport comments on sports for NPR and is a columnist for the Chicago Sun-Times. Well, Liz Ehrman is a music teacher at Cohen Hillel Academy in Marblehead, Massachusetts. She gave her students a simple assignment: write their own lyrics to the classic O Shenandoah. Well, Liz is here with us in the studio. Liz, can you give us a sample of O Shenandoah?
O Shenandoah, I long to see you. Way, hey, you rolling river.
Here is what Liz's students wrote.
Oh, Red Sox, we'd love to meet you. Oh, yeah, you are the best.
every single one of Liz Ehrman's fifth graders wrote about the Red Sox and the Yankees. Liz is with us in the studio, as I said. Liz, what happened? Did you coach them?
It was amazing. I had no idea what was coming. And there were three groups of three in this class, the one I recorded, and every single one of them independently wrote about the Red Sox or the Yankees.
It says a little bit about the fever.
It's humongous. You know, I'm a music teacher. I don't know anything about sports, so I didn't even see it coming.
What did you expect them to do?
You know, I thought they'd write about their dog or their mother or a class that day. But all they could think about was the baseball game.
Oh, Yankees, we love to hate you. We're gonna beat you. Oh, Yankees, we love to hate you.
Liz, as a teacher, how do you feel about the phrase, "Oh, Yankees, we long to hate you, we are going to kick your butt," showing up in a writing assignment?
Well, I learned that next time I present a writing assignment, I'm going to have to say that it must be in a positive context.
Oh, Yankees, we long to hate you.
Well, Liz, thank you.
Thank you.
Liz Ehrman, music teacher at Cohen Hillel Academy in Marblehead, Massachusetts. Let's listen again, shall we?
Oh, Red Sox, we'd love to meet you. Oh, yeah, you are the best. Oh, Red Sox, we'd love to meet you. On your way to the championship, you'll win the World Series.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, as President Bush meets with Asian heads of state, we'll look at one of the leaders he will not be greeting, Kim Jong-il of North Korea.
Also, intelligence officials called it the most dangerous terrorist cell in the U.S., but were six Arab Americans now in jail for a decade more foolish than fearsome? That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, Americans ordered out of Gaza after three U.S. officials die there.
And when it comes to services that help people manage credit card debt, buyer beware.
You can't trust any particular trade association or any particular nonprofit status. You need to look into any agency, regardless of who they are, and ask a lot of questions about what they're charging and what sort of services they offer.
Also, author attorney Scott Barrow on the death penalty.
I really didn't know, and perhaps even today don't know, whether the death penalty is moral.
These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Steve Brown. U.S. Embassy officials are advising Americans to leave the Gaza Strip following a deadly attack. Three Americans were killed and another was wounded today when a remote-controlled bomb went off underneath a convoy. Daniel Kurtzer, U.S. ambassador to Israel, says the Americans were on an official diplomatic mission.
The security personnel who were attacked were part of a convoy of armored vehicles, including American diplomats with official business to conduct in Gaza for the American embassy. Among their planned activities were interviews of Palestinian academics who have applied for Fulbright scholarships to study or teach in the United States.
The U.S. is asking the Israeli government to help evacuate any American who wants to leave. Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat is condemning the attack, calling it a, quote, awful crime, and ordering an investigation. No one has claimed responsibility. The United States is expressing optimism the U.N. Security Council will act favorably today on a proposed Iraq resolution. France, Russia, and Germany have asked that a timetable for the transfer of power back to Iraqis be included in the resolution. The United States has refused that request. U.S. diplomats say they will still get the 9 needed votes to approve the resolution. Jury selection continues for one of the 2 Washington, D.C. area sniper suspects. Lawyers are hoping to have a jury of 12 plus 3 alternates in place by the end of the day for the trial of John Muhammad. Potential jurors are being asked if they have been affected by news reports of the sniper killings and if they could impose the death penalty. 2 pilots for the U.S. military are okay after their jets crashed into the Atlantic Ocean off of South Carolina today. The Coast Guard says it rescued the pilots, who were later reported in good condition at a naval hospital. According to the Coast Guard, the planes were based at Beaufort Marine Corps Air Station. No word on the cause of the crash. The apparent flawless launch of the Shenzhou 5 capsule capped off China's decade-long space program effort. The rocket carrying a 38-year-old fighter pilot turned astronaut was launched yesterday from the Gobi Desert in China's remote west. China has had a rocketry program since the 1950s. The budget for the program is secret, but foreign experts say it totals at least $1 billion. On Wall Street today, the stocks are mixed. The Dow is up a point at 98.14. The NASDAQ is up 6 points at 19.49. It's 33 minutes past the hour.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
The U.S. State Department has advised all Americans to leave the Gaza Strip after a roadside bomb killed 3 Americans traveling in a diplomatic convoy today. A 4th American remains in critical condition. No group has claimed responsibility for the attack. When U.S. officials returned to photograph the bomb site, they were pelted by stones. Palestinian police shot into the air to drive off a half dozen stone throwers as the Americans fled in their vehicles. Joining us on the line from Jerusalem is Molly Moore. She's bureau chief for the Washington Post. And Molly, I know you went to the site of the explosion. You were there as American officials came to examine that bomb site. First of all, what did you see?
Well, I was right in the middle of the scenes that you were just showing. And what was happening there, there were large groups of young Palestinian boys who basically use this as an anti-American rallying point. And it's not so much anti-American, but they are opposed to America's support of Israel in this conflict. And the arrival of these two investigators with very little security in a situation where the Palestinian military did not have had not cordoned off the car was just a recipe for exactly what you just saw.
Well, Molly, you say it was not so much anti-American, and no one is claiming responsibility, but is it in some ways being seen as a shift in tactics and an Iraqification of the conflict, if you will?
Well, you know, it's yet to be seen if it's a shift. This is clearly the first time that Americans have been targeted. In fact, the first time that any sort of foreign diplomats or a foreign official have been purposely targeted in this ongoing conflict. There was a case of some observers, international observers, who were shot and killed on the West Bank last year, but it turns out it was an accident, and it was, and Palestinian militants believed that they were settlers. So this is a very different type of incident. It's the first of its kind. Mm. It's a little too soon to tell whether this is going to be a shift in tactics.
And Molly, aren't some Palestinian officials, in fact, saying that they want more international and American observers there, not fewer?
Well, absolutely. And one of the problems is that the American observers who've been here on this team have not been very public observers. They've operated in secret. They've shied away from the press. They've not held either side accountable in public. They've held private meetings with both sides. And so there is criticism from the Palestinian side and from other international groups that these monitors should be much more upfront in what they're doing, much more public, and should be putting their observations on the record much more rather than holding closed-door meetings.
Mm. And very briefly, Molly, we only have about a minute, but the American Embassy, as we said, has advised Americans to leave the Gaza Strip. Who would these people be? I mean, I'm assuming aid workers and perhaps some missionaries or scholars, but and are they going?
You're exactly right on who they are, journalists, aid workers, but also individuals from the American Embassy frequently visited Gaza. They were not restricted from going there before today, as long as they had security. They did have security today. It was the security vehicle that was apparently hit. You know, I have not heard of people fleeing Gaza. I think most of the people who work in Gaza know the dangers, know you know the flashpoints for trouble, and are fairly well versed normally in staying out of trouble. At the same time, you know it's a war zone. There's a lot of shooting. There's a lot of mines laid, whether they're directed at Americans or Israeli tanks. So it's a very dangerous area. So you don't have many people who are down there on a whim.
Molly, thank you so much. Molly Moore, Bureau Chief for The Washington Post in Jerusalem.
Well, if you watch even a little TV, it may not surprise you that more Americans than ever before are behind on their credit cards, judging by the slew of ads offering advice on how to get out of debt. 9 million Americans have now sought such advice from credit counseling services. But the Internal Revenue Service and Federal Trade Commission are now concerned enough about the quality of the advice to have opened an investigation. Yesterday, the IRS and FTC issued a rare joint advisory to consumers about what consumer advocates call debt mills. Joining us on the line now is Deanne Lunin, who's a staff attorney at the National Consumer Law Center. Welcome, Deanne.
Thank you.
Deanne, first off, something that surprised me, these credit counseling companies are nonprofits, right? So they're exempt from dozens of state and federal regulations.
Yes, that's correct. Nearly everybody in the industry has nonprofit status.
And what is the impact of that nonprofit status on how well they can be supervised?
Well, there's a number of impacts. There's an impact on consumers because they aggressively sell their nonprofit status, and people are programmed, and correctly so, to believe that a nonprofit status means something, that they can think that someone who has nonprofit status may actually be more legitimate or more trustworthy, and that's not necessarily true.
Deanne, you wrote a report on credit counselors back in April, and you came to similar conclusions that seemingly prompted the FTC and IRS to investigate these agencies. What did you conclude?
We found that a lot of them are charging higher fees than we thought were reasonable, both fees for consumers and, for the most part, for education services, for budgeting services, and to set up what they call debt management plans.
And we also see that they continue to rely, in many cases, almost exclusively on contributions from credit card companies themselves to fund their services, and that there's a real conflict there.
What do you make of that?
Well, we think that the credit card companies themselves actually really hold the strings for a lot of what's going on in this industry.
Hmm. But it's in the credit card company's interest to get its credit card paid, naturally enough. At the end of the day, do these counseling services help people get out of debt or not?
Yes, a lot of them do. And we think that for those that offer multi-services, they counsel, they help with budget services, and they also offer this program where you can pay back the credit card companies, that for a lot of consumers, this can be a good thing. But for a lot of consumers, it's not a good thing.
And it's not a good thing, you say, because they tend to be too expensive? Is that your main problem with them?
Well, they tend to be too expensive. And also, frankly, for some consumers, they need to prioritize their debts. And, for example, if they're choosing between continuing to pay a mortgage versus making what can be pretty large payments on their credit cards, they may actually have to make the choice and go with their secured debt, their mortgage, or their car debt, and temporarily or maybe even for longer let the credit card debt go, or at least not pay it back at the high rate that the credit card company might expect under one of these plans.
I see. So you're suggesting that they pressure people into paying that credit card before other things are paid off.
That can happen, yes.
Mm. So, Deanne, what is your most fundamental recommendation to someone who finds themselves behind the credit eight ball on their credit cards?
Well, unfortunately, at this point, you can't trust any particular trade association or any particular nonprofit status. You need to look into any agency, regardless of who they are, and ask a lot of questions about what they're charging and what sort of services they offer. I think what's going on right now with that IRS-FTC advisory that you mentioned is that hopefully a lot of the bad players will start getting out of the business. But in this transition time, it's really a consumer on alert status.
Caveat emptor, buyer beware.
Absolutely.
Deanne Lunin is a staff attorney at the National Consumer Law Center, which is based in Boston. She spoke to us from Virginia. Thanks, Deanne.
Thank you.
You're listening to Here and Now.
The Supreme Court decision to hear the case which will determine the constitutionality of the nation's Pledge of Allegiance has reignited the controversy over church and state. The phrase, "one nation under God," which was added to the original pledge in the 1950s, is recited daily by millions of schoolchildren across the country. Michael Newdow is the California father who claimed the Pledge of Allegiance, as recited by his daughter, violated the Constitution. And Michael joins us now on the line. Hello.
Hello.
Well, I want to ask you first, Michael, to react to the news that Justice Antonin Scalia has recused himself from this case. He hasn't given a reason, but many suspect it's because you filed papers asking him to do so. Tell us a little about your request for him to recuse himself and your reaction that he did. Are you surprised?
Yeah, I think it's quite remarkable. I didn't expect that he would. I thought that he needed to. I think the law is fairly clear. It says that when there's any appearance of bias, the judge is obligated to recuse himself. But the way it works is it's up to the justices themselves, and you know, they can just ignore the request. And I think it's quite admirable and courageous of Justice Scalia. I really do. My opinion of his, which was high to begin with, is even higher.
Well, it is, as some say, also going to possibly have an effect on the case if the case ends up in the Supreme Court with a 4-4 vote. Let's back up and remind people, why did you ask him to bow out?
In January of this year, he attended a Religious Freedom Day that was sponsored by the Knights of Columbus, which is the organization that was responsible for putting the two words "under God" into the Pledge of Allegiance. And in that venue, there's no recording of what exactly he said, but it was reported by the major newspapers that he said that the case was wrongly decided, or intimated that it was wrongly decided by the Ninth Circuit. There's a code of ethics that says you're not allowed to comment on a case that's going to be coming before you. He knew it would be coming to the Supreme Court. And you're certainly not allowed to say it was ruled incorrectly before you've read a brief. And that certainly gives the appearance of partiality, which is all that's required for recusal.
What impact do you think his stepping out of this decision is going to have on that decision?
On the decision, I don't think it's going to have any impact, because I don't think there's any way I can lose this case. The law is overwhelmingly on my side. The principles underlying the Establishment Clause are overwhelmingly on my side.
And remind us of that for those who haven't heard you. I know you've spoken on this. Why do you think it's on your side?
Oh, I mean, it's clear. You know, if you try to put into words what the Establishment Clause means, you know, what is it doing there? It's, you know, the Supreme Court has tried to come up with a number of tests, for instance, the outsider test, that nobody should be made to feel like an outsider because he or she holds a religious belief that's different from the majority. The neutrality test, government should remain neutral in matters of religion. The purpose test, is the law passed for a religious purpose? Does it have religious effects? Does it place government's imprimatur on any religious idea? On every one of those tests, clearly sticking the two purely religious words, under God, and implying that there is a God when that is a religious question open to individuals' determinations, violates every one of those tests.
But, Michael, as you know, what does this do to our $1 bills, to coins, to all the other places where under God is accepted in our society?
Well, it's accepted by those who like having God in their government, but that's precisely what the Establishment Clause forbids.
Well, Michael, thank you.
It's my pleasure.
Michael Newdow from California. And here is the late comedian Red Skelton's take on the pledge.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Since I was a small boy, two states have been added to our country and two words have been added to the pledge of allegiance, under God. Wouldn't it be a pity if someone said that is a prayer and that would be eliminated from schools, too?
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Scott Turow is the author of renowned and best-selling courtroom dramas, such as Presumed Innocent and his latest, Reversible Errors, which is about a death penalty case, which is interesting because throughout his writing career, Scott Turow's also been a practicing attorney who's been involved in, among other things, two major death penalty appeals. In March 2000, Turow was chosen by then-Illinois Governor George Ryan to serve on a Blue Ribbon Commission looking into the death penalty. Governor Ryan had become alarmed at the growing number of reports of death row inmates who'd been wrongly convicted. Turow has chronicled his experiences with that commission and his sometimes wrenching reflections on the death penalty in his new nonfiction book, Ultimate Punishment, A Lawyer's Reflections on Dealing with the Death Penalty. Scott Turow joins us in the studio. Welcome, Scott. We're so happy to have you here.
Thank you, Bill. I'm proud and pleased to be here.
Scott, all your books are a kind of unraveling, plots that grab you and hold you. But this book's an unraveling, too, of your position on the death penalty. You write that for many years you considered yourself a death penalty agnostic. What the heck is that?
I really didn't know, and perhaps even today don't know, whether the death penalty is moral. More significantly, I didn't know whether, if I were in charge politically, I would favor or oppose the death penalty.
You were open to the possibility in those days of executing people.
I was more than open to it. Even after I had begun doing a lot of pro bono work and was working on one case where my client clearly was innocent, even though he had been sentenced to death. Even then, when I was asked by the abolitionist community to stand with them in opposition to the execution of Illinois' most famous serial and mass murderer, John Wayne Gacy, I couldn't do it. I wasn't ready to say that was the right thing to do to Gacy, but I was willing to say that the judgment of my community was certainly a reasonable one.
Yeah, well, maybe we'll get back to John Wayne Gacy, who murdered 33 young men, later in our conversation as we get to the position you're at now on the death penalty. But first, talk about one of the cases that had an enormous impact on you. Just briefly, the Alejandro Hernandez case.
Yeah. Alex Hernandez and his co-defendant, more celebrated co-defendant, Rolando Cruz, were both convicted and sentenced to death for the abduction, rape, and murder of a 10-year-old girl named Jeanine Nicarico. Terrible crime, excited a lot of racial tensions in Chicago. But about 6 months after Hernandez and Cruz were first convicted, a similar crime took place about an hour away, and another man was apprehended. And when he began plea bargaining, he said not only had he committed this second murder, but also he was the one who had killed Jeanine Nicarico. For 10 years, the prosecutors then refused to accept that confession. And only when DNA evidence emerged and a police officer came to court and admitted the testimony he'd given before was false, were both Cruz and then Hernandez finally freed.
Did that change your mind right away about the death penalty?
No, it didn't, because, Bill, the behavior of the prosecutors in that case was so execrable, so far beyond the pale. I thought, well, this doesn't prove anything. All it proves is that, you know, if you put the wrong people in power, everybody is in danger.
Still, anyone falling through the cracks, you started to feel, was one too many.
You know, I even wasn't ready to be resolved on that, because I didn't know exactly what the death penalty did for us. And these were all these questions that I sort of kept pushing aside.
When you came to the commission.
When I came to the commission. But, you know, for example, we do have institutions that we adhere to. We give children inoculations. And the statistics will tell you that every year some innocent little child's going to die. But we know it saves more lives.
And we get in our cars, which can be lethal instruments, too.
Right.
But the greater social good,
right,
as some will say about the death penalty, is that you got to drive a car, and the greater social good of capital punishment is it deters crime. Yeah. Well, does it?
I will say, as far as I am concerned, the answer is a resounding no.
One wrenching section of the book, though, is when victims came before the commission, people who'd lost a loved one to a murderer.
Right.
How did that affect you?
Well, it's very affecting. I mean, some of these people have...
I mean, these are people, I should explain, who believe in the death penalty. They want a sense of closure to what happened to them by the person who killed their loved one being executed.
Right. I mean, they believe that it's just punishment. But if we think that the reason to impose the death penalty is because the victims want it, then we should impose it in every case where first-degree murder is found. But we don't do that. 49 out of 50 people in this country who are convicted of homicide are not sentenced to death.
One of your concerns is that in certain murder cases, certainly in all murder cases, it's horrendous. But in some murder cases, there's almost an impossibility, you seem to feel, of getting a straight jury decision because there are so many emotions swirling around.
Oh, I this is something I'm really persuaded of. And I think you see it again and again in the innocence cases across the United States. And I refer to this as the paradox of capital punishment. The Supreme Court has basically instructed us to reserve capital punishment for the worst of the worst, the most egregious, the most inflammatory, the most hideous and unimaginable murders. And by definition, those are the crimes that are going to most excite the unruly passions, not only of a community, but of the police who are trying to please and pacify that community, of the prosecutors who most often are elected by that community, of the juries that come from that community, even the defense lawyers who and judges who've got to live there. And time and again, as in the case of Hernandez and Cruz, we have seen people convicted on slight, sometimes laughable evidence when the nature of the crime is as abominable as many of these are.
So, Scott, what did the commission conclude and recommend? And where are you now? Where do you stand on the death penalty?
We took our pragmatic job as recommending reforms to the Illinois capital system. Many of them have now been adopted by the Illinois legislature. There's a certain amount of political wrangling left, but I think we're all optimistic that substantial reform is going to be enacted in Illinois. Beyond that, though, our former U.S. Senator Paul Simon, a hero of my youth, great man, was a member of the commission. He said, look, I'm not letting you out of the room without taking a sort of sense of the commission vote. Who's in favor of capital punishment? Who thinks it ought to be abolished? And when we started, there was a clear majority in favor of capital punishment, and when we finished, there was a majority against it. And I was one of those people who had migrated during that two-year process.
We talked earlier in our conversation then about John Wayne Gacy, who murdered 33 young men, stuffed them in a crawl space under his house. You have to now hold the position that he doesn't deserve the death penalty because it can't be administered fairly enough.
I don't hold the position that Gacy doesn't deserve the death penalty. That's not my concern. And indeed, what I realized at the end of the 2 years is I had spent most of my life, like many Americans, asking what I thought was the wrong question. The question isn't whether or not Gacy deserves the death penalty. The question is, can you design a legal system that imposes the death penalty on Gacy without also imposing it on few people who are innocent and a larger number of people who've been selected for death on a largely arbitrary basis, often for crimes that are of much lesser magnitude? And after being able to look at the system for a couple of years, I realized that the answer to that right question is no. We're never going to be able to design a legal system that sifts that finely.
Scott Turow, thank you very much for joining us on
Bill,
this.
Thank you.
Scott Turow is the author of a number of books. His latest, though, is Ultimate Punishment, A Lawyer's Reflections on Dealing with the Death Penalty.
Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
Our production team includes Andrea Shea, Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Alan Cockle, Karen Miller-Medson, Lindsay Crudell, Jordana Gustafson, Emiko Tamagawa, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna.
Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Tim Skog and Boris Drapachki. Our web producer is Zach Christo, and our interns are Ed Walters and Ann Stevenson.
The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now.
Six Arab Americans are in jail for up to a decade, but were the young men from Lackawanna more foolish than fearsome?
And journalist Peter Moss tries to unravel the mystery of Kim Jong-il and North Korea.
That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.